Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. We are going to do a very special edition with our resident Canadian crime slash union slash underworld slash business world consultant and analyst, color commentary, Kem Ferreira, who's been great to us and is really, this guy is salt of the earth and has really showed a lot of personal resolve in standing up against some of these forces that we're going to be talking about. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ben.
Yeah, Benny, the producer, who's really my MVP. He's my MVP, man. He's got me up and running in a 21st century media that I was slacking on for the first like 15 years of my career. So, Kenny, I wanted to bring Kenny on and do a little bit of analysis and dissection of some big reporting that we had here at the Original Gangsters Podcast, as well as our companion web magazine, The Gangster Report. We've been on top of all the chaos that's been going on in Canada the last couple of years, specifically tied to the war that was, and we're going to get to that in a second, that was raging between the Rizzuto mob, the Sicilian Rizzuto mob in Montreal, and the Hells Angels across Quebec and Ontario. And we were able to break the news that there was a historic peace summit where the leader of the Rizzuto clan, Leonardo Rizzuto, and the street boss, if you will, of Hell's Angel Nation. I mean, this guy, Marty Robert, he's not just a powerful Montreal biker boss. He's global. And they sat down face to face for the first time in at least 2.5 years and squared their beef. And it happened at De Emme, which is a pretty fancy, trendy Italian restaurant on the site of an old women's prison.
Absolutely. The food is great. I went there once, and it's a very trendy, very upscale restaurant, and a lot of hockey players and a lot of mobsters. It's kind of funny, but it was like, it's a place. And by the way, kudos for your story, because second it started on your podcast, I contact some people, and a lot of journalists were saying that was full of shit. It was bullshit, the story. You know, they were trying to minimize the story and saying, listen, if it happened, we would have known. And slowly but surely, all of them, kudos to them, because they called me back and they told me, Ken, tell your friend he was right. Maybe it wasn't an 8-hour meeting, but it was, right. It was a meeting. He says between those two guys, and it was the restaurant, and it was the date you told me. So it's kudos to the guy or the girl or the person that gave you that info.
I was able to get it from multiple people. One person kind of led me down the right, or I should say two people actually kind of pushed me in the right direction. And then another two or three people were able to confirm and color it up for me. I want to just dive in right now and something that you said when we were off air, mm-hmm. when this first was going on, or when I was first able to report this right at the end of 2024. And this happened on December 11th, which was a Wednesday night. Yeah. You said, and now I'm going to just kind of let you go. You said that by having it where they had it at the MA, they obviously wanted this in some way, shape, or form to get out to the press, to the media, to the public. That they, if they wanted it to keep a cap on it, they would have done it in a top secret location. It would have been done at a trendy Italian restaurant, even if it wasn't a basement secret room or whatever.
Absolutely. And when you told me the restaurant itself, to me it was. It was they needed projectors on that meeting. They wanted to show everybody that this is very important, because what they're doing is they're showing to the rest of Quebec underworld we're united. You're not gonna use us against us, you know, or some form of it. So I mean, this was made, like I said, the Emma was known for a lot of hockey players and a lot of mobsters. You know, a lot of them used to go there, and that's it. So the cops knew exactly. And like I told you before, one of the journalists told me, listen, if they went to the Emma, we would have known. And it was kind of funny that, you know, you got it before them, you know.
Across the border.
Well, that's what I was telling Ben. It's like, you know, imagine if I'm in Montreal and I know a secret in the Detroit Lions locker room before anybody in Detroit, you know. So it's like you scooped them, and it's kudos to you for sure. And but they all came back. So at least, you know, they tipped their hats because they told me, listen, the info is right. You know, there's might be some stuff. You know, like the 8 hours, maybe it's a bit less, right. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't take away the storyline. This is major, major story. You know, like one of the most ancient and most influential families in North America, the Rizzutos. You know, like the fifth family, and they're with the King of Kings. We could say in the bikers. So they meet together, and it says a lot.
I think, you know, to drill down a little bit, I think that, first of all, what you said about them wanting this out there, I think Leo wanted it out there, that the Rizzuto family, that all the things that had been written and said, me included, that this could be the end of the Rizzuto crime family, that they were on the ropes, that they were about to be absorbed by the Hells Angels, and the Rizzutos would just be a subunit of 81 Nation. I think he wanted it out there that, listen, we might have been on the ropes, but we swung off the ropes.
And a rope-a-dope.
We're standing as tall as ever. And I think with Marty and the Hells Angels, I think they wanted it out for more of internal purposes from my reporting, that there were pressures being applied outside of Canada, because again, Marty's global, and from our reporting here at OG Pod and at Gangster Report, the seat of power in the Hells Angels right now no longer goes through California, where it did for decades. It doesn't go through New York or Boston or Oakland, which is California. It goes through Canada, and it goes through Marty Robert and Walter Stadnick in Ontario. I think that they wanted the people that were, I don't want to say that they were, there was no do this or else, there was no line in the sand per se, but there were, from my reporting, there were powers that be in both the United States as well as some other countries that were telling Marty and, I guess through Marty Nergit, that this is bad for business. This is bad for everybody. This looks bad. And what's really what's the end game here? Because if it's to do what you thought you could do, it probably would have been done by now.
Absolutely. And don't forget, Scott, you know, the Rizzutos had a reputation of, it's bad for business. They'd never wanted violence on the road, on the streets. You know, they thought that we could fix everything without using the big V, that big violence. And I think Marty Robert was that type of guy also, you know, that it just came out of their, I don't think that they wanted this, but I believe also there's demographics, meaning that, you know, the Hells Angels are getting older. I know there's a lot of recruits, but they're still getting older. And the mob, the Italian mob, is the same thing. They're getting older, you know. So they're seeing a lot of foreign and exterior powers challenging them power. So maybe they told themselves, listen, maybe it's better if we stop this war against us and join forces, because we got a bigger fish to hunt now, you know, and that's this is completely meter, but I'm just saying here, I don't believe that it was good for their business to continue on having this war, because it was an endless war, you know.
The union that had served both of those entities so well for, you know, 40 years, absolutely, was upended for two and a half years. Again, I don't really see any true gains on either side. So it really is, you know, when you're talking about practicality and being pragmatic and being smart, which both the leaders of both of these groups are, I think that they saw that that this wasn't benefiting either of them, and coming together, like you said, was going to serve them well, as it had for all those years before. And now you kind of got to untie some of the knot that was bungled up in this war, which then spawned a bunch of proxy wars. And you have a lot, and I think this plays to what you were saying before, where you have a lot of younger guys that don't necessarily have the awe that you might have had previously with the Italian mafia or even the 81, the Hells Angels. And they're kind of, you know, young and reckless, and they all wanted to kind of jump in, and everybody kind of took a side, and sometimes those sides were changing. But now it's like, how do you untangle this? And from what I understand, that's really the only loose end here, is getting the street gang elements that were fighting on behalf of one or the other to kind of cease and desist, and everybody go back to playing in the sandbox together.
It was the outsiders who are gaining, with this war. Not really, you know, the ones who established their principle. And don't forget, you know, Gotti and Sammy the Bull, in a certain sense, you know, they were the young guns, right? And they never saw their leaders. He was always, you know, reading the Wall Street Journal, and you know,
he was on
And it reminds me of the same thing. It reminds me that, you know, it's like the Hell's Angels, or the higher ups, and the higher ups in the mob were just forgotten their roots. So a lot of these guys had no direct contact with them, and saying, listen, it's time to challenge them. And this is where, you know, I see them coming together, because it's better for business, and it's a business.
I think I also want to get your take on this. And if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, I understand. And I want to be delicate when I bring the subject up. Because I don't want to have any potentiality of inciting violence based on speculation. But it seems like if you were doing a, you know, a cost-benefit analysis or an autopsy of what just happened, it seems like the only loser here potentially could be the Desjardins faction, that had once been with the Rizzutos and was part of the initial insurgents, right when Vito Rizzuto went to prison, and all of the bloodshed that came after that, leading up to this other war that erupted between the Hells Angels and the Rizzutos. And we know that one of Desjardins' main guys, Jack Simpson,
joined
in his 80s, joining the Hells Angels. And again, I don't want to speculate too far out, but it seems like now that the Hells Angels and the Rizzutos have put aside their differences and are back joining forces, I'm not saying that he's in danger necessarily, or I'm not saying he's in danger, but it seems like any move that he could have made to go around Leo Rizzuto and those guys has been ended, because now the only lanes that he had have been obstructed.
Well, the power force, we could say, maybe the outsider, is Renan Desjardins. You know, if he can't put the beef behind him with what happened with, you know, Rizzutos and all that, maybe, you know, he's the odd man out. You know, I'm not going to blame him for having that beef, because, you know, while he was in prison, they killed one of his lieutenants and all that. So, but, and don't forget the Malo, was he was the that's it exactly. So will he be able to turn the page? And that's the only if I could say I could see, you know, will he join, you know, the outsiders? That would be like incredibly, you know, like the old guy with, you know, the new outside force of challenging the Hells Angels and the mob. I don't know, but maybe he just sat down and that's the second step. Maybe they're going to sit down together and say, listen, we need to have another conference at the Emma with you.
Do you think that myself and other journalists that were covering this, I mean, this is kind of rhetorical, underestimated Leo Rizzuto? And in fact, he was or is built for this more than I and other people gave him credit for. He's not some sophisticated, I mean, he is sophisticated, but he's not some fish out of water as he was kind of being portrayed. You know, he had gone to law school to not go into the family business. It was going to be, you know, his older brother, Nicky, and then his older brother, you know, gets killed. His grandpa gets killed. His brother-in-law gets killed. His dad dies of cancer. And it's kind of like, if the empire is going to stand, if the legacy is going to remain, he's got to step up and take responsibility. And I was wrong. I was saying that maybe he wasn't ready for this. Maybe he wasn't built for this. But I think talking to people that I've talked to and doing, I think he really proved himself as a war general.
I think you're right in a certain way. I think everybody underestimated, not just you. I think everybody underestimated what was happening. Everybody thought the Rizzuto was over. The Rizzuto dynasty was over. After Vito died, everybody, anybody you speak on the street or from law enforcement, they said, it's time to go. You know, they even gave them ultimatums and all that. And he stayed there, so meaning, you know, he gained back about a bit of his clout that maybe he had lost. And don't forget, his right-hand man, if I'm not mistaken, was Solicito, who's fighting cancer, right? So, you know, it was not a one-man show, but he had money, but he had the clout, the family name, but he didn't have the reputation to be on the street, like you're saying. And I think it's all to his, if we can say to his glory, you know, to what he's accomplished right now. I don't know, I'm not in the secrets, but you have to understand that he was playing with major, major players that wanted him out. So this reunion is remarkable. That's why I said, you know, it's an incredible scoop, because nobody would have predicted a meeting 6 months ago between these two people, these two major players, you know?
And I think that the fact that it happened in the weeks before the holidays says something that people wanted. As 24 was coming to an end, and it had reached basically the two-year mark, because I think the tensions really started to bubble in October of 22, and then it became public in March of 23 when Leo you know, survives an assassination attempt. But the tensions really, the violence started in October of 22 with Chit Del Basso surviving his own assassination attempt.
But you have to also, you know, Gregory Woolley, you're very loyal to Rizzuto's, but close to the Hell's Angels, you know? So when he left, it's in a certain way, maybe got people together would not be because we didn't know where he was going to stand. You know, are you really a soldier for us, or are you still loyal to Vito and all that? So maybe after he's gone, maybe, you know, it opened up the doors for other people, because, you know, he wasn't very in line with Casper, and Casper's very close, I think, to Marty. Marty, and that's it. So I mean, the stars aligned in a certain way, you know.
And I think that there was also some history repeating itself. You mentioned Greg Woolley, and it reminded me a little bit. you know, if you went back 10 years, you know, a decade before Willie was murdered in November of 23, you know, or a little bit more than a decade, when Vito Rizzuto came out of prison and was out for 14 months before he succumbed to cancer. And just on a side note, yeah, I kind of have an idea in my head. If I'm interested in possibly penning a book just about those 14 months from October of 12 to December of 13. And I'm not making any commitments or anything, but if I was going to do a book about what's going on, I would like to kind of get with some journalists maybe in Canada.
It's an incredible story and an incredible timeline.
Yeah.
With ponytail, with Ducamp Joseph also, that yes, people don't talk too much, but you spoke to last podcast I heard from you also, a very influential 67 gang street kingpin, you know, that died, I think, I can't confirm it, but we think maybe it's Gregory Woolley. Behind this?
He might have been involved in it, but
Freddie Silva, right?
He admitted to being the trigger man.
He was the trigger man. Okay,
wasn't involved in the conspiracy.
Okay.
What I was saying though, in terms of history repeating itself, it was like when Vito came out, there was no playing both sides of this. Vito said, "You're either on my side or you're on that side. You can't be this, oh, well, we like you and we
George like Bush." He was George Bush Jr.
right.
During the Iraq War. You're with us or you're against us.
Right. And there were some guys, you know, one that comes to mind, Joe Bravo, Juan Fernandez, who is caught on a wiretap.
Who died in Sicily, right?
Right. But was caught on a wiretap, you know, talking. I don't know if he was talking directly to Vito or somebody that was relaying for Vito and said, you know, I'm going to stay out of this. Yeah. I love you and I love Desjardins and I don't want you guys to fight and I don't want to choose a side.
You can't do that.
And they said, no, that's not how it's going to work. And then he was, you know,
Damalo. At one point, right, he didn't show his, you know, he don't forget, he was part of the Catroni clan, right? And Rizzuto picked him up. Kept them with him, you know.
Damalo went all the way back to the 60s.
Exactly. You know, and when he didn't show loyalty to the core of the Rizzuto family while he was in prison, he was gone. You know, he was gone.
And just in these court records that we've been able to get, some of the press in Montreal have been able to get their hands on, and I've been able to see them afterwards. And we talked about this on another podcast. You know, Smiling Joe Damalo lasted less than 3 weeks after Vito Rizzuto got out of prison and actually showed up at the Rizzuto estate begging for his life. And said something along the lines of, or this might have been in the phone call that was overheard by his family, but said something along the lines of, well, what was I supposed to do? He's my brother-in-law, meaning Desjardins. And I heard from good sourcing that the response on the other line was, what were you supposed to do? You were supposed to kill him. I don't care if it was, this was coming from Vito Rizzuto. I don't care if it was your brother-in-law. So it's interesting that Greg Woolley, you know, based on my reporting, was in a similar situation. It wasn't exactly the same, but he's a guy that was, you know, the ultimate deal maker and power broker and had to choose a side. And I think at the end of the day, he did choose the Rizzuto side, but it was almost maybe too late. Because by that point, he had alienated so many people in the Hells Angels and ended up, he was a big head on the wall
when he tried to hire Mom Boucher in prison to kill Desjardins, you know. I think that was part of his proving his side, but maybe exactly what you're saying, it was a bit too late or whatever. So maybe that's why he's the odd man out. So it's very, you know, the mob stories are incredible here in Montreal. And don't ever forget that the reason why we're at a certain level, it's not because we're more dangerous. It's just the laws make it that we have much more liberty here in Montreal, and mobsters can roam much more. There's no recall law. There's no 100 years in prison. There's no, you know, you get caught, you do time 15 years and you're out, you know, and that's a picnic for some of these guys, you know?
I think another factor at play, I'm interested to get your take on this, is that there might have been, and there was, some real major consternation at the top at both of these organizations. But if you went down a couple rungs, and I'm not talking all the way to the bottom, I'm talking just still in the space where there are, you know, shot callers, not necessarily the
high level leadership.
Right. These were guys that on both sides really liked each other and were friends. And again, I'm saying this is beyond the actual, like, the top combatants, the top guys, but some of the guys right beneath them on both sides were close. And I think, you know, one of the motivations to put this aside was, I mean, I'm going to just brass tacks it, and I'm not trying to besmirch anybody's ability to kill or their toughness, but I think on both sides, there were guys telling their higher, I don't want to have to kill this guy. I like this guy. He's been over to my house. I know his family. And I think it was coming on both sides of this. And I think there might have been some pressure, not just from the outside, but not pressure, but consensus that this, you know, for everybody's sake, we don't, not that they don't have the heart, but that it just is going to do way more damage than any, you know, any benefit coming back from us or coming back to us. And you had some guys that, you know,
I'm just saying, I believe you're right on it. You know, I mean, if you don't have to kill, you know, and after I've been working with you, Scott, for 20 years, we've been doing stuff together. And all of a sudden I get a shot caller telling me that I got to shoot you, or I got to kill you, or I got to get rid of you, or I can't even speak to you anymore. That's it. You know, so now if I'm caught speaking to you, I'm becoming an enemy of the state. So it's kind of, you know, they don't want to. And I really do believe that the younger generation, the outside gangs, weren't paying their dues, really, to the Hells Angels and to the mobsters, to the mafia. I mean, that too had some percentage of play, because we better join us together, because these guys do not play the same rules as us. You know, don't forget what Woolley said when he tried to interfere and to say, these guys are nuts. These guys, you know, they don't want to speak. They don't want to converse. They don't want to have no deals or no meetings. So I think, you know, they're getting older. And I always believe that when you're getting older, you're getting a bit less. You don't want to be on the streets that much. You know, you love that high-end life. Your kids are not in that. Nobody's carrying a gun these days, you know, who's the son of a mobster. Very rarely, you know. And who's carrying the guns are 15, 14-year-old, you know, street gangs, who say, it's enough is enough. I'm not going to pay that tax. I'm not going to respect that guy anymore. And in a certain way, you know, they saw it coming. And I think it's a join us, or else we might die. Maybe, and, you know, I'm speculating. I'm not saying it's 100.
I think also, and I want to throw this out there and get your take on it. So you had some of the U.S. Hells Angels and some of the guys outside of Canada sending word to maybe, like, let's pull back on this. This is bad for everybody. But on the other side of it, I'm told, and you mentioned Stefano Solicito, who's battling cancer right now, Little Sauce, whose dad, Rocco Solicito, was a right-hand man to Vito Rizzuto and then became a successor and then was assassinated. But my reporting is that Stefano had for the sake of his health, as well as he's fighting, or could be fighting some serious legal charges in the future. He's the top suspect in a murder that
exactly
predated this war, but was involved in another ebb and flow of the wars that came after Vito Rizzuto, when his empire came under fire. So from what I'm told, Pete D'Adamo, who was Rocco Solicito's driver, who then became a captain and is now in some type of relationship with one of the Rizzuto's sisters. He, I'm told, played a big role in convincing Leo that this was the best thing for everybody, and that there was, understandably, a sentiment from the Rizzuto people that had nothing to do with organized crime sending word to Leo, we can't handle any more of this mentally and emotionally. And I think that was being represented by Pete D'Adamo. And there was kind of Leo's own family saying, we don't want to go to your funeral.
Absolutely.
Look how many people in our family that we've buried.
Listen, in any negotiation, you always have that horse whisperer, right? that guy or that woman who's in back of you and saying, listen, you're going to lose. You're going to lose us. Your right-hand man, if you continue on this vengeance tour or on this, you know, we understand you lost your family. We understand this, but you're going to lose. You're going to die. Everybody's going to die off this. So sometimes there's somebody who has to come in from left field and says, like what you said, the driver, and he says, listen, sit down. Put your differences aside. You know, everybody's lost in this war, you know, and maybe that's what happened.
Well, obviously, Pete D'Adamo was trusted by the Solicitos. Rocco trusted him. I'm told that Stefano, this wasn't a situation where Stefano was, you know, moved out of the underboss spot, that he, you know,
agreed,
laid the foundation and ushered Pete D'Adamo in because his dad, Rocco, had thought so highly of Pete D'Adamo. And I also think, and again, I got to own my own, you know, stuff that I predicted that was either not true or didn't come to fruition. I think a lot of people, including myself, were saying, if I'm Leo Rizzuto, I'm not staying in Canada. I'm going to another part of the world. And I don't know exactly where Leo Rizzuto was, but I'm told he never left. He was living bunker style.
He wasn't living in Venezuela. He never left. He stayed in Montreal. And listen, even trying to kill him, it showed that he was always going to the same places. You know, he was followed in certain ways. You know, he got out of it, but he was followed. So he wasn't hiding like everybody thought he was hiding. You know, he was in your face still. You know, everybody knew he was here.
But even then, even after the assassination, where people had Del Basso's guys and Marty's guys clocked his movements in the spring of 23. It was pretty shocking to me when those court filings came out and you found out that he was, at that point in time, after all the stuff that happened with his family, he was not traveling with any security entourage. He was going by himself in his car to the same restaurant headquarters every day, leaving at the same time to go home every day, using the same driving route and not having a bodyguard with him. It's a miracle that he wasn't killed. And absolutely, if those guys would have really done what, dare I say, they should have done and just left him in the parking lot, he wouldn't have been, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here. But absolutely, they decided they wanted to be cowboys and get him on the highway or the expressway, and they missed. But I want to be clear that I think there was a lot of thought and there was a lot of predictions that he had left, that he had tapped out, in the sense of, he wasn't going to be in, he wasn't going to be shot calling. He was in a different part of the world. And now my reporting is coming back and saying, no, he was living low and wasn't popping his head out. And nobody really saw him for a year and a half that didn't need to see him. But he never left Canada.
He never left. Which maybe that's one of the reasons they were able to sit down, because he showed what type of person he was from the underground world. You know, like, I'm not hiding, I'm not leaving, I'm gonna stay here, and what happens, what it will happen, but I'm not gonna run away. And maybe that's, you know, that's a way that they, Marty or anybody else around them said, listen, it's time that we settle this. You know, it's speculation, but it makes sense, right?
Yeah. If we wrap this up, just kind of talking about the actual event. So again, there's some contrasting narratives on timelines and in terms of the exact amount of time they were sitting together. And it, you know, the couple of people that I talked to could have very well been exaggerating. When I first reported this, I was told that it was a 6 to 8 hour meeting. After that, I've been told it was probably closer to 2 to 3 hours. Either way, they were together. Both of them had a second. Marty had Fess with him, his right-hand man, Fess Plouffe. And I'm told that Leo had Pete D'Adamo. And then there were security teams for both that were like, you know, they had both groups had more than a half a dozen to a dozen guys either in the restaurant or outside the restaurant, making sure that everything was copacetic and nothing broke out. And I'm also told that one of the conditions that Rizzuto and D'Adamo insisted on was that this take place in a place that was considered, you know, their turf, their territory. I don't want to, whoever owns the Emmy, I don't want to make it seem like they're in the mob or with the mob. I have no,
I understand
that, or I'm not alleging that, but that these guys felt comfortable doing it there, and Marty and his people agreed to do it there. Can you kind of speak to that?
Well, honest to God, when you told me about this story, I said, you know, the 8 hour thing, we spoke about it, you know, but even if it was only 2 hours or 3 hours, when you have your lieutenants or people outside that restaurant, which is already known as a hot spot, you know, not a hot spot in the sense that there's danger. It's a hot spot that's saying you're in a safe area here. Nothing's going to happen to you in this area, you know. And like I said, high-end people of every walks of life go there. So they want it to be seen. They wanted this to be established as, listen, this is our treaty. This is our meeting. This is our treaty. This is, you know, United Nations. We're sitting down here and we're going to sign a paper here. And it reminds me of when the Rock Machine sat down with the Hells Angels, you know, and they made it public. They made it. And to me, it hit me right away. I said, this is a public showing of force, not only to their groups, to tell them, listen, stop, but to the outsiders who are trying to say they're weak and we want them now. We have them on the ropes. And that's what I saw from your reporting. You know, I mean, that's what I saw, which is true or not, doesn't matter, but it's my opinion.
And I think it's also, drawing a line from when we first started this discussion, I think it was a signal to the government, to the police, to the SQ,
absolutely,
saying, hey, we've gotten the memo that this has jumped the shark with you guys. And when innocent 7-year-old girls with their moms traveling from France end up getting blown up in firebombs, and 14-year-old boys end up getting, you know, charred, set on fire because of being sent to do the dirty work of guys in their 50s, that this is it draws the ire of the government in the same way when the kid
exactly
in 1996 in the great
the Bible. government will react very simply. They'll give a lots of money, bigger budgets, and there's going to be more arrests. And who's going to pay for that? Them. So we better fix our own yard. And, you know, and we might save us from going down that road, you know. And I think it was a very well thought meeting. I think it's beneficial to both, to all of them. And from heads to toe, it will help them survive, you know, and grow.
I want to just hit on two more things. And then real quickly, and then I want to give it over to you as we close out to give an update on some of the union stuff and some of the sanitation, construction, value sphere story that we were talking about a couple months ago. But the first thing, as we're wrapping up about the Hells Angels and Rizzuto mob, the war coming to an end, it's interesting. Someone pointed this out to me. And I guess you could include Chick Del Basso. He was a former member of the Rizzuto mob. But if you take him out of the equation, there were no members, there were no Hells Angels or actual Rizzuto mob members that were killed. All of the casualties were
outsiders,
proxies.
Yeah.
Even Greg Woolley.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the guy Dooney, who was killed 10 days before Greg Woolley, Dooney Guerin, who was a collector for the Hells Angels, but was not an actual Hells Angel. Now, Chick Del Basso, I think, falls in that gray area where he was so you could consider him a mafia member, I guess. What does it say to you, though, that in they're estimating that there was between 8 and 12 murders, a couple of them, you know, accidental, that were the result of this two and a half year war. What does it say to you that in the 2020s, a war like that can happen, and it's really the two organizations that are at war aren't really feeling the death blows. The organization's feeling it, but the actual members of the organization aren't the ones in the coffin.
Well, I consider that a bit of collateral damage or a loose ends, you know, that were fixed. The only loose end we could still see that's alive and ticking might be Renat Desjardins. Yeah, if we're just using our strategy or what we're using. But apart from that, it was always, like you said, you know, it was outsiders, subcontractors, if we can, you know, the contractors stay there, you know, the engineering firms stay there, but some of the subcontractors took a hit because they weren't paying ball, or, you know, they it was a show of resistance also. We got to get rid of some people, you know, until we find out that we have to stop this war, you know. And these guys were too bad, but it's, you know, they weren't part of the future.
Tony Suzuki almost
absolutely,
but he was a mob member that was Team Hell's Angel, and you know, he fought off assassins that were trying to kill him and possibly his daughter.
Absolutely,
hand to hand combat in front of a restaurant. They came up to him,
a 70-year-old man. Yeah, you know, pretty.
So last thing before we turn to value sphere, my reporting said that by the end of the peace summit, it wasn't just that peace had been achieved, but everybody was drinking, everybody was toasting, and that they left. This is a kind of proverbial, but they kind of left with everybody's arm around each other.
This Kumbaya.
It was, everybody was happy. Everybody was smiling. Marty and Leo were getting along, and we should let people know that, you know, these weren't combatants. And again, I know I'm belaboring the point here, but these weren't combatants that didn't know each other. These guys all knew each other very well.
Yes.
What does it say to you that they were able to walk away with smiles on their face.
It shows what you said a bit at the beginning of our podcast, saying that they didn't want to kill each other. This was time. They were just starving for affection in a certain way, you know. They were just waiting for that proper moment to sit down and say, listen, it's enough, and we got enough, and it's better for all of us. You know, I can't live like this for the next 5 years, and you can't be stressed out like this, and we will lose business. Not only are we going to lose our friendship, our business, but we're going to lose our loyal soldiers because they won't be able to hold the fort anymore. So, I mean, I think it was at this two-hour thing that you're saying is typically, it was a truce and a real truce. And I think it's stronger than ever now. You know, for at least 5-6 years, I think it's going to be stronger than ever for them because they want this to work.
And then I'm going to segue. I'm going to show some tradecraft here. I'm going to segue into the value sphere. I think one of the major critical leverage points here that has been remedied was that the Hells Angels guys, specifically Fess and Casper the Ghost, they were holding the strings on the contracts for the sanitation, for the environmental hauling, for the construction, and they were using that to block
absolutely
affiliates from getting contracts. So
there's always money behind all of that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I just want to make a little really fast because I know we don't have a lot of time, but Valusphere was barred for 5 years, okay, for lack of integrity from a division here in Quebec. And one of their role players was Louis-Pierre Lafortune. Okay, Louis-Pierre Lafortune, who got caught in the public inquiry, very close to the Solidarity Fund, very close to the Hells Angels, very close to big major players like Renal Desjardins and Casper, we met that he went. So this is why I think that Desjardins is, because of Simpson going as a, what do they call them before the Hells Angels? He's a prospect. And Renald is very close to Louis-Pierre. I think Louis-Pierre has still a lot of clout that can speak to all of these guys because he's a bit of a weasel, but he's a good businessman. You won't tell him. But what's important is Valusphere, right after that, they said, we're going to get you out of the five-year contract of ordering contracts for the city. They redid the law in a certain way, and now they said, listen, as long as Louis-Pierre is not part of this company anymore, we're going to... So it's almost like banks, too big to fail. You know, they know that these companies are huge. They have a lot of trucks that take out contaminated soil and bring it to other places. So it's kind of funny. And Louis-Pierre, so you understand, very close to an ex-Hells Angels who works now for Valusphere called Stéphane Ménard.
Yeah, we talked about him in our last pod.
That's Stéphane Plouffe, the one you're talking about, was sitting down. He also was very close to a money laundering guy for the Hells Angels called Roberto Amato. Okay. And when they wanted to go public and bring it to not Wall Street, but to the stock exchange, they went to get Tony Papa. So this is Louis-Pierre Lafortune. And so people understand, Louis-Pierre Lafortune in 2008 went to get the Minister of Finance, the Liberal Minister of Finance, which Jean-Marc Fournier, and did a fundraiser for him and gave him a lot of money. He also said, listen, I gave $1 million to Denis Vincent, which was a helicopter pilot, who was very close to the Hells Angels. So he could help me in business plans. And this Denis Vincent was an unknown guy, but sat at the Solidarity Fund for a lot of meetings. So all these tentacles are part. And Louis-Pierre Lafortune has an enormous web of influence. And Valusphere, maybe he's out. But Valusper, all of a sudden, is back at workplace, still loading trucks, still being able to do all the contracts with the government because they got rid of that player, which is he really gone? That's the main.
And I think, as you said, there's a couple guys that you can connect in that web that have clear, you know, ties and links to you know, influential members of these organizations. That
don't forget Louis Pierre Lafortune. Louis Pierre Lafortune. So we make this simple. He was the man who set up a meeting between me and Renal Desjardins. So I would stop what I was doing for the head pin of the FTQ construction. And Renal told me, what do you want? What type of job do you want? Whatever. And at that time, he says, you can be leader of the FTQ the whole, or you can come and work for me, because he was selling high-end doors and in high-end condos and all that. So Louis-Pierre Lafortune is a player that never leaves, still is there as an influence, enormous influence in the political sphere, but also very close to the mobsters.
Well, Ken, this was great. I'm glad that you could jump on and break this down with us. You provide tremendous insight and perspective. You want to talk about the inside man? That was Ken, and now he's doing the you know, the work of like I said, he's salted the earth, and he's out there now fighting the good fight, making sure that everybody knows that this terrain, illuminating this terrain, and you know, knowledge is power, especially
absolutely,
in this world.
Absolutely. And letting people know. And it's just to put people in perspective, you know, to find out, because what we are saying, like you're saying, you give me the liberty to say stuff, but people understand that maybe what we're saying today is only going to happen in 2-3 years, but get ready for it. You know, the environmental, the garbage industry, it's developing to this environment. And then, you know, there's so much money to be made because of the green vision of, you know, so, and the mobsters are in front of this by a long shot. You know, they're like ChatGPT. They're in front of it. They're smarter.
The environmental scams has been a kind of a undervalued bread and butter of a lot of organized crime groups, not just in Canada, but in the US. And it's something that you don't think of, you know, cleaning up the environment or being as, you know, green as you can, and trying to get rid of your fossil fuel imprint and your carbon imprint, and all that stuff. You don't necessarily connect, you know, environmental politics with the underworld, but if there's a buck to be made, these type of people will find their way into that space. And I remember I worked when I was in law school, I worked for the Attorney General office in Chicago, and they kind of move you around to different departments. And I remember getting put for a period of time, I was put in the environmental unit. And I remember being like, I was upset that I had gotten pulled off. And then when I got there, I was like, no, this is really interesting stuff that is involving the same guys that are doing, you know, the hits and the loan sharking. But they're just doing it in a quieter space.
And if I may, just one little thing before. Michael Milken, remember the junk bond king?
Yeah, junk bonds.
The environment is, there is no law. There is no law. So it's the Far West. So you can do anything almost, you know. And it's always speculative. It's who decides what. And there's so many ins and outs, making them $1 billion industry, a billions and billions.
You can shade it as being like, hey, we're trying to help the environment.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and the construction industry, you know, you buy, you get carbon credits, you know, and your asphalt, you're making it, then you're using the old asphalt and you're putting it somewhere else when you're supposed to put it, you know, in a pit. So it's a beautiful, beautiful business. And to me, it's the Far West. It's still not regulated. So that's why they're making their dues there.
Well, Ken, thank you so much. If you're game, I want to obviously I want to bring you back on a at least a semi-regular basis to be our color commentary, our color commentator, our main analyst on a lot of this stuff, because nobody has a better inside perspective, not many, than Ken Pereira. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it. One last thing. Again, sorry. One of these days, if we sit down together, I'd love to talk about cops, but bad cops who are associated with the mob here in Montreal. I got three or four great examples, and I think it's good for the listeners, because it's an incredible story of some cops, what they did to get branded, you know, with the mob, well, and what they did.
Organized crime can't exist without dirty law enforcement. I mean, that's tried and true. That goes back 100 years.
Yes, sir. Al Capone and all that stuff.
Well, you have I hope you had a great new year. And again, we had Ken on, I believe we had him on twice in 24. And now I want to have him on at least three or four times in 25. So be looking for that. Thanks to everybody. Please spread the word, like, share, subscribe. The OG Pod will be here giving you your true crime fix, whether it be across the border in Canada or over here in the United States. We got North America covered. Scott Bernstein for Ken Pereira and Benny behind the glass. We're here at OG Pod, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. I'll see you next time.